Welcome to Three Women, Three Ways. We're the show that tackles some tough topics sometimes. Today, I don't think it's, well, kind of a tough topic, but not as tough as some, because we're going to kind of get to know the associate director and the program called the Safe and Together Institute. Welcome, Heidi Rankin.
Thank you so much. It's so wonderful to join you.
Well, I'm glad you're here. And we have something in common. We both graduated from the program at UC Denver, and you're a more recent graduate than I am. I graduated way back in, 2008, I think. And,
followed you in 2010.
Well, there you go. There you go. So from that, I presume you're way younger than me.
Don't count on it.
It seems like everybody on the face of the earth is way younger than me.
right.
So, and I must say, the director of the program is Barb Paradiso, who's been on our show a couple of times. Your voice is remarkably similar to Barb's.
Oh, well, I take that as a compliment. So, thank you.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. It kind of took me by surprise. I thought, wait a minute, did I dial Barb? I have only met you via email, and you sent out an email to the program on domestic violence, and they are having their 20th anniversary next year, and so they're doing all sorts of planning, et cetera, and you responded to one of those emails. And so what piqued my interest about your email is you said, first of all, that you're the associate director with the Safe and Together Institute, and I'm going, Safe and Together Institute. I have not heard that before. And then you said, you threw out this tickler, you may have heard about the Safe and Together model, focusing on the intersection of domestic violence and child maltreatment. And my spidey sense went boing, boing, boing. Of course, there are intersections there. So
right.
Why don't you start at the beginning? How did you get involved with this? And then we'll talk more about what that program means.
Sure. I have been working in the domestic violence and sexual violence field for close to 30 years, and I've done that work in Eastern Canada and in the U.S. And during that work, it was inevitable, as I was doing either front lines service provision or we're creating policies and legislation, that kind of thing, that I began doing some kind of collaboration with the child protection agencies, as we were, it wasn't unusual that we, my agency, or even I personally, were offering services to survivors and their children who were engaged in the child protection system. So there was a sort of a natural fit that it seemed that we were serving the same clients, and that there were ways that we were hearing from survivors that they were not feeling, validated or acknowledged in the child protection system, and it began to intrigue me. And when I was in fact around the time just after I finished my program at UC Denver, I started doing some peripheral work with the Safe and Together Institute, and hearing some of the training, and one of my colleagues was beginning to do more work with them, and I was truly intrigued. It was the first time that I really heard about the intersection that really made sense to me, talking about it from a perpetrator pattern-based approach. When I finished
Wait a minute. You're blowing me away.
Okay.
Perpetrator pattern-based approach. Oh, you're saying all these wonderful things that are just getting me so excited. But I want to interrupt for just a second, because you had very gently said something about the feelings of domestic violence victims and the child protective system, how they were not, I believe you said, validated or something. I've actually been hearing some really hideous horror stories about the intersection of the intimate partner violence victims and child protective services from other parts of the country. I was surprised when you were kind of gentle about characterizing that relationship. In my view, it's pretty bad. I mean, starting with courts requiring women to you know, to allow access to a perpetrator father, and yet Child Protective Services saying, oh, if you allow access to this father, we'll take away your child. I mean, I've heard some real horror stories. Can you talk a little bit more about that relationship between Child Protective Services and domestic violence victims?
I would be delighted to. And I can say that earlier in my career, I would have, I also had a bit of a bias around child protection and their interactions with survivors until I started working with them and understanding a little more about good intentions and fear and anxiety about child safety, and seeing really clearly that there was a huge gap in what they understood about domestic violence and what survivors were doing towards the safety and well-being of their children, and that coming from a place of fear and liability, that they were making decisions that really were so myopic and were really holding, and still do, hold survivors responsible for perpetrators' choices and behaviors. And the niche that the Safe and Together model works in, the entire goal is to be changing practice and doing paradigm shifts in the child protection system to support them to have better skills around partnering with survivors, around working with perpetrators, around really their assessment lens, their documentation lens, their interviewing lens, their case planning lens. In all those areas, they feel ill-equipped to be doing the work from another way. And when in, and I do a lot of training with them, and it's really so encouraging to be in rooms with people who I think have one of the hardest jobs. I have a lot of respect for the responsibility they have, but to see that paradigm shift, that penny dropping, when they realize that, in fact, they have been doing the practice wrong and that they didn't know how to do it differently, and have been coming from and are trained into a failure to protect paradigm against the survivor. So in other words, again, holding survivors responsible for perpetrators' choices and telling them, if you let him in, if you get back with him, if you expose your children to domestic violence, we'll take your children. One of the worst threats I can imagine in the world. I just, you know, as a mom, I just can't even imagine what that would be like. And so this approach is really about turning all that on its head.
Okay. Now, explain to me more about what is this approach? And then we'll talk about how it evolved.
Sure. So this approach, I can tell you that a sort of a core baseline training is 4 days long. So it's fairly intensive, and it's specifically focused on practice change. So it does not stay at the theoretical level. It's really about giving child protection workers, advocates who work with clients who are engaged with child protection, service providers, substance abuse providers, mental health providers, all of these agencies and organizations that touch the lives of those engaged with child protection need to be coming from a lens where we call it a perpetrator pattern, survivor strength, and child-centered approach. So it's about keeping children's safety and well-being at the center of the work, and doing the work from when I commented before about a perpetrator pattern-based approach. So no matter who we are talking to or interviewing, or we are and keeping kids at the center of that work, we're doing it from a framework where perpetrators are responsible for their behaviors. And the goal is to create case plans and service plans where we have done our best with carrots or sticks around motivating perpetrators to change their behaviors. Because if we're not intervening with perpetrators around their behaviors and their choices, then we can never expect a different result for children. So survivors can be doing, you know, jumping off buildings in a single bound, they can be doing heroic efforts towards the safety and the well-being of their children. But if the source of risk and safety concerns are landed with the perpetrator's behaviors, then that's what has to change in order for us to be assured of child safety and well-being. And well-being is an important piece of this. It's not just about safety, but it's about child and family functioning. It's not it's keeping the kids at the center. We often deal with this kind of work, and child protection is still challenged to think about it as an adult-to-adult issue. Perpetrators would like us to stay in a place where we see it as an adult-to-adult issue or a relationship issue. This has nothing to do with my children. This is all because, you know, my partner did or didn't do this or that. I never meant anything to happen to my children. And what this is all about is doing that kind of assessment and documentation and planning around how perpetrators' choices and behaviors are impacting children and their family functioning. So if you think about children, you know, to date, we really have been thinking about if children don't see or hear domestic violence, then they are not dealing with the trauma. And, you know, we're not worried about them. We don't have to stay involved with that family if that child is staying mostly with grandma or is with grandma on the weekends when things seem to happen. We've been stuck in those places without really doing an assessment of what is harm to kids around domestic violence and what is the impact of that harm on children. And that's what really needs to be front and center if we're going to be doing assessment around are children safe? And can we close a case so that we are not concerned about the children anymore? And how do we do that? What do we actually do around that? And so there's lots of tools that we train on and that we offer around mapping perpetrators' patterns of behavior, around mapping survivors' strengths and protective capacity.
When you say mapping perpetrators' behavior, what does that consist of?
It's a very specific tool that guides workers or collaborative, you know, multidisciplinary meetings or supervisors and workers that really takes them through a process to identify the perpetrator's patterns of behaviors, identify the harm to children and not just physical harm, and to identify what the survivor's strengths and protective capacities are within the context of the perpetrator's behaviors, and to also look at what the impact on the children is, which is different than harm. Harm might be, harm would be if a child sees a parent arrested. Harm would be if a child hears one parent, the perpetrator, name-calling the survivor or telling the survivor, usually the mom, that they're, you know, not worthy and calling them names. That's harm to children. When we talk about impact, we're talking about the impact can be behaviorally or educationally or socially, that kids are impacted by the harm that is created from the perpetrator's behaviors. And then one more thing that is a really important piece of the mapping process in this particular tool, there are many, but this is a foundational, is the intersection of domestic violence and substance abuse and mental health. Because what we know is that in cases, we hear up to 80% of child protection cases that involve domestic violence also have issues around from the perpetrator or the survivor or the child, behavioral health issues, substance abuse issues, mental health issues, and we can't be doing that work in silos. That's a really important piece of the work that we do because we traditionally do. Whoever has a substance abuse issue is sent out for substance abuse services. Whoever has a mental health issue, and it could be both, could be all three, then they're sent for services. But there's not a connection made between the domestic violence and those other issues. So in other words, is there assessment being done around if the perpetrator is causing those issues or exacerbating those issues or maybe interfering with treatment? So many layers of assessment being done to really get the narrative about what's happening.
Okay. It sounds to me like you have an intersection with court services. Is that true?
Yes. Now, you know, in our piece of the world, we would encourage when we're doing training, and if Child Protection is bringing us in for training, we encourage always that the audience is diverse. So we would encourage them, if they're Child Protection, we encourage them to bring in domestic violence advocates who are working with clients. We encourage them to bring in the court systems so that, because what happens when this practice changes is that there's a change in language, there's a shift in language that we would like everyone to be hearing and seeing and using. There's also a shift in documentation, and we want that to be shared. And what we hear from court systems is that for years, what they're getting for documentation, which is all they have to work with, is that they're seeing in documentation that there's a history of domestic violence, or that the couple engages in domestic violence, which gives them zero picture about what's actually happening and a zero picture about how are we going to be assessing the safety and well-being of this child. Can this child be in this home? You know, what are our worries? What are you putting in place for interventions? What are some possibilities for interventions? What agencies, what systems are engaging perpetrators who can be part of the accountability around behavior change? So it definitely is a multidisciplinary approach to families who are engaged with the child protection system.
Okay, so it sounds to me like your main role as an organization is training and dealing with organizations that have to make these kinds of decisions. Direct service?
We do not do direct service. We do support around that. So we do, sort of various things. I would say training is one of the most frontline kind of things that we do. We also do organizational assessment to really determine, you know, where an agency might be in their practice. We train around using tools, and we offer support around doing that. We also do evaluation around these kinds of issues to see about actual change and being able to confirm change when practice changes. Do outcomes change for families and particularly for kids? And so it's a bigger picture in that kind of a way. But training would be foundational. We have online learning courses, and then we have in-person training, which would be all the way from the sort of the core training that I told you about, training for supervisors. If practice is going to change, how do we supervise around that? Advanced training in the intersection of domestic violence, mental health, and substance abuse. So quite, many, many layers in this kind of area.
Okay. So you deal with child protective services. It sounds like, do you deal much with court personnel?
Mostly in areas where they are part of training. We do direct training for court personnel. That has been, judges have been a large audience in the last few years, engaging them and getting them, to the room to be doing this kind of training. I have an interesting story about that, which, I think is meaningful. It's meaningful to us to really see that. So, and I'll make it as brief as I can. There were judges in the room. David was doing a one-day training to give them sort of an overview of this. And two-thirds through the day, this judge stood up and said, as a judge, I don't like feeling vulnerable, but I have to stand up and say that I work in a domestic violence docket. So this is my full-time courtroom, and I've been doing it all wrong. I've been making decisions without any rich information, without a narrative that actually gives me a picture, because what I've been seeing in my documentation is history of domestic violence, engages in domestic violence. And he said, that gave me nothing. I didn't realize that. And I was making decisions based on what I saw in front of me, which often was a distressed mom for fear of losing her children, and perhaps a very charismatic father who seemed to have better resources and was more in control. And I was, and he said, and I made horrible decisions for hundreds of children. And he said, and I now realize that I've been making decisions based on no accurate information. And that was profound, just in that kind of a setting.
Yes. I mean, for yes, a judge but then to the, admit that is, I mean,
I
profound
know.
Is
very
amazing.
Profound, very profound. And then 3 months later, he sent
him a poster child, you know.
Right,
you know,
right.
That,
because it even got
that
better.
That man on a trophy. Yeah. You know?
Yes,
I mean,
it even got better.
Yeah.
3 months
How?
Later, he sent an email to David, who is the the originator of the model, and he said, "Here's what I've done to change my practice to incorporate what I learned and the sort of epiphany I had." He said, "If someone comes up to my court and hands me documentation that says history of domestic violence or that," he said, "I hand it right back to them, and I say, do not come back to see me with this case until you have a clear documentation about the patterns of the perpetrator's patterns of coercive control, the harm to the children, the survivor's protective capacities in the context of those behaviors, and the impact that this is having on children. And until you have that information, I will not hear the case." Profound, really profound.
Amazing. It's just amazing. I have to tell you that a couple of years ago, I put out a call, and you know our show is national and international, and I put out a call. I said, I want to talk to a family court judge. I want to talk to a family court judge. And after calls to different states, I finally was referred to a family court judge in Denver who, boy, she gets it. She gets it. She's the one you want to talk to. Okay.
Great.
So I had her on the show. And
wonderful.
I asked this woman, no, it was not. I asked this woman, please tell me what goes through a family court judge's mind when there are two people in front of him or her, one that has domestic violence in their history. And I purposely said that because I didn't want to be in a, well, he said, she said. I said documented
right.
domestic violence in their background.
Mm-hmm.
And another one who is, who does not have domestic violence in their background. And I said, what goes through the family court judge's mind that he or she would actually choose to place children with the perpetrator, the documented perpetrator? And
right.
this woman who supposedly got it, who came on high recommendation because she understood it, said, well, you have to understand. You've got two people ahead of you, in front of you. One is calm and in control and has his act together, and the other one is frantic, and she just can't even take charge of her own life, let alone that of her children. So unless if the domestic violence isn't that bad, we'll give the children to the father, the perpetrator, until she gets her act together.
Oh, God.
I practically fell off my chair. And this is the judge who got it?
That's
God help
exactly.
us with the ones who don't
Exactly. I know. And think of, think about the families and the moms and the kids and, having kids
yeah.
removed. And there's just too many stories of that exact story. Too many.
Well,
just too many.
And, the issue that these controllers control, and they can control themselves, and they can come across looking very fine. And
yes.
you have a mom who is in a courtroom facing off against somebody that she knows has an unblemished record of getting his way.
Mm-hmm.
And she's terrified that she's going to lose her children, and you expect her to have it all together?
Right,
And clearly.
There's just so many. We can tease that out for hours. That's right.
Yes.
That's right. Yes.
That judge did not have a clue. And what it sounds like to me is that have you had much success actually training judges? I know you said you've had some come and this one what remarkable case where he actually got it, but do you find judges normally resistant to this kind of education?
I think probably the biggest reason that we don't have opportunities. So we have great opportunities at conferences and things where there are judges. Judges are, you know, and I'm generalizing here, but judges aren't the first group to say, we don't get it and we'd like some more information. So could you come and, you know, and help us through that? And frankly, they don't know what they don't know. And so, and our training is, you know, we are invited in to train. So we, the limitation that we have is that we can't mandate anybody to be in a training. And agencies who invite us in to train may or may not have those kinds of relationships with the judicial, you know, judges and prosecutors and those kinds of things. When they do, and they do invite them, it can be very successful. So it's more of a resistant population around training. And I used to be told a fair amount, especially in Eastern Canada, that we can't do training because it might increase bias. We have to be objective and unbiased. And somehow they made the link to learning new information might make them biased instead of objective, which
don't
has zero logic.
It might influence how I think.
Right, right. And I, you know, and I can't be whatever, coerced, manipulated. I can't, you know, so we're not going to age in this. We've, you know, we've got all the training we need to be good judges up here. And so there's more of a resistance in that setting. And again, I'm making generalizations, but as a, you know, as a group, they are, we find that they're less available, willing, and able to be in the room, especially for, you know, for any kind of in-depth. I mean, we get it that, you know, it's hard for many practitioners to get to be away from their office for 4 days. So the training is really, the 4 day training is really focused on practitioners and helping them to change their practice, which, and then we can do overview days to share with a wider audience so they understand the model, they understand what's going to be different in their community, what they might see different in documents, what they might hear differently, and how it impacts families. And that's a very successful kind of introduction to it. But it is a harder population to have that kind of in-depth. It's getting better, I have to say. We've been, the last 2 years, been doing a whole lot more work with that population, and successfully. When they're in the room, it's a little hard. The model is really, when everyone sort of gets immersed in it a bit, it's a little bit like, how are we not doing the work this way, right? How is it that we're holding survivors responsible for perpetrators' behaviors? How did we get here? And if you can help us shift that practice for better outcomes, then we're in. It's the bigger discussion. People don't know what they don't know.
Yeah. Well, and the issue with the judges, of course, is judges are judgmental. They
right.
have to have confidence that they know
yes.
how to evaluate something, and they have to make decisions. So,
that's right.
You know, I don't know whether that's personality or whether it's, you know, I don't know, you know, but I mean, it's kind of like the nature of the beast is to
yes.
be confident that you know how to judge, and that's that.
That's right.
So, that being said, it still becomes a huge issue. It would be interesting. I would love to have that judge who got it be on my show to talk about that. Because
right.
that is a huge realization on the part of that judge. I mean, that's just an amazing thing.
Yes.
Okay.
And I'd like to share that as a piece of hope.
Yes. Yeah. So that's one.
Yes.
Yeah. There's one. Okay. the other issue that seems to pop up so frequently, And I must say, I this embarrasses me because I'm working on my PhD in psychology, and I gotta say that a lot of psychologists and psychology reports and evaluations that I read, I'm just mortified. I am absolutely mortified. And psychologists are called on all the time to make evaluations that judges will then rely heavily upon in making decisions. So do you work with the psychologists a lot, or is that also a reluctant group?
That can be a reluctant group, and we would actually, you know, sort of stand on the premise that we not pathologize domestic violence and that we not pathologize survivors and perpetrators. Because this is about coercive control and choices. And so, you know, I think we would hold that that's an area where we would like to see agencies within the system move away from using that as a tool. Because, as you know, domestic violence is not caused by mental health. It's not caused by substance abuse. It's not caused by any of these things. And when we pathologize it, we can set it up to be, so if they could be, you know, fixed in some way, that the domestic violence wouldn't be an issue, which just is not at the core of the work about perpetrators stopping their behaviors, that it's a choice that they're making. Even if they are coming from a trauma history, you know, we talk about in the child protection world, their trauma history is important. And in that sort of bubble of child protection work, it is not an excuse and can't be used in that setting. They make choices in all other settings, often very, you know, as you know, often very productive and very well respected at work and in the community and all those other places, and that they make choices to be controlling and abusive and violent in their intimate families. So that is not a trauma issue, that is not a psychological issue, that's a choice around behavior issues. So there's a place for perpetrators to be able to deal with their trauma, and they may be childhood victims of domestic violence themselves, and in the child protection setting and system, that is not the goal of child protection, to heal a perpetrator's trauma. The goal is for them to intervene with perpetrators to stop behaviors that are putting children at risk.
Right. You mentioned earlier about mapping a perpetrator's behavior. Can you go into more detail about that? Well, how is that done? Did your organization come up with that methodology? Tell me more about that.
We designed the tool and used the tool. It's one of the most popular tools that that workers take away with them because it's very concrete. So it's really looking at, you know, important to make sure that we're grounded in the perpetrator's patterns of behavior in order to be doing assessment for around anything else. So this is about what are our sources of information around the perpetrators' patterns of behaviors? And obviously, survivors and children are a huge source of information, which is one of the reasons that we talk about and train around skills to partner with survivors in this work, acknowledging that they are doing things towards the safety and well-being of their children. It's not saying survivors, that no survivors have issues that need to be addressed, because that can be the case. But if we're talking about domestic violence and they are a survivor, it's important that we be able to work with them and partner with them because we have the same goals. Because child protection and survivors want exactly the same thing. They want the violence to stop and the children to be safe. And when you can come from that place, of working together, it can be creating a partnership that can move that forward. But so what we need to be looking at is, what do we know about what the perpetrator has done to harm the children and what they've done around coercive control. So it's literally capturing that. So it's not about, it's very specific. It's not about the perpetrator uses name calling. That doesn't tell us anything, right? So assessment and really getting down to that is really, if there's name calling, it's about saying, what does that look like, right? So it's about describing and documenting what are the names that that he calls. It's not okay to say the perpetrator is intimidating, because we don't know what that means. It could mean many things on a spectrum. So what we need to be talking about is, what does that actually look like? So it's like, tell me what that's like. So it's capturing, it's training workers to be doing assessment that's very behaviorally focused and fact-based. It's a really important part of the model, so that we're not working with biases around, you know, having low expectations for fathers and high expectations for mothers. It's being able to not have gender double standards in the system to be doing this work. So it's a really important piece of getting behaviorally focused, so that we're not making assumptions, which really helps around gender, helps around race and ethnicity. If we stay fact-based and behaviorally focused, and that's what we're capturing, that's what we need to be able to do this work, and to be able to identify what does this mean to the children. And if we're really getting down to the perpetrator's behaviors, then, you know, we can also do assessment around, what has mom been doing in the context of what we know about what he has been doing or has done? How does that help us to understand her choices and decision-making around the children, right? Because out of context, we, you know, anybody who's worked with survivors has probably had times when we've all said, and why did you make that choice? Or like, that, you know, because it, out of context, it doesn't give us what we need in order to understand that. And so,
well,
the mapping tool.
Survivors' behaviors are always questioned.
Exactly.
And doubted.
That's right.
Yeah, that doesn't, yeah.
Making bad choices. We hear a lot about survivors making bad choices. It really talks about if you cannot make that kind of assessment unless you're connecting her choices and behaviors, et cetera, having to do with the kids within the context of the perpetrator's behaviors. Because when people say, well, I don't understand why, you know, she has to keep, you know, calling everybody. She's making everybody crazy because she keeps asking, can you give me a ride to school or to get, you know, Sally here or to get, you know, to go to the doctor or whatever. And they're like, you know, they've got a car. She needs to take more responsibility. And without the understanding that the perpetrator withholds transportation, then you can't be giving context to why she's asking for that kind of thing. So we talk.
Yeah.
So it's really important to be thinking about, in that context, how is that the perpetrator's choices are parenting choices. So when a perpetrator is choosing to withhold transportation, they're making a parenting choice, because how are those children, you know, what if there's a medical emergency? How are they getting, are they even able to get to extracurricular activities or to medical appointments or to school or to any of those kinds of things? And we're asking everyone to be thinking about their choices as parenting decisions when children are present, when there are children. So if you think about, you know, a perpetrator's choice to show up at their partner's workplace or text her, you know, 100 times a day or do all of those kinds of things, and she loses her job, his choice to do those behaviors has now impacted child and family functioning, because that's a change in income, perhaps. Maybe there's even then a necessity to move, or they're evicted because there's one less income. And that we need to be tying back to perpetrators' choices as parenting decisions has caused this child to have to leave a neighborhood where they felt comfortable and had friends. They have to change schools now because they have to move to a new neighborhood. They may be moving away from extended family and support systems, and we can trace that back to the perpetrator's choices and choices as parenting decisions. Does that make sense?
That makes sense to me. Knowing what I know and based on my experience of having interviewed others, knowing what I know about court systems and decision makers and people who so heavily influence the family fate when domestic violence or intimate partner violence rears its ugly little head, I'm kind of surprised at how forward-thinking your organization is. And I'm wondering, you know, it sounds like it's pretty well accepted. Is this just in the Denver area, or is this nationwide, or
No. How
is this? No? What's happening?
This the genesis of this would have started actually in Connecticut, where David many years ago was doing perpetrator programming and running perpetrator programs. And child protection in Connecticut at that time, and this would be, you know, 20 years ago, would ask him to come and help them understand perpetrators better. They knew that they didn't know how to work with them. They were afraid. And so he began to consult with them on that. And the genesis of the Safe and Together model was born. At this point, we are international. And we have over 100 certified trainers around the world who are doing this work. So I never know how I feel about this, but the issues are the same around the world. I never know whether that gives me a little relief or that just it feels so awful, but the issues for child protection around the world are exactly the same. So the model is stable and its application is infinite. And as a result, as the work began and people began to really engage in this and change their practice, we were no longer able to do all the training that we were being asked to do. And places like Scotland and Australia are countrywide taking this on. So when we talk about a domestic violence-informed child protection system, we're talking about the child protection system itself and all of these other agencies and organizations that we talked about that touches these families, including judges, including law enforcement, including all of those. And what they determined was that the issues that we hear when we travel and train are exactly the same around blaming, around holding survivors responsible for perpetrators' choices. You know, perpetrators' choices and behaviors look the same. It's, you know, children are being harmed really similarly. There could be cultural differences, but it doesn't change the work. And so we began a trainer certification program a few years ago in order to build capacity around the world where people were looking to make these changes. And it's very exciting, very exciting. And if you're talking about a domestic violence-informed systems, then we're talking about everything from frontline work all the way to our laws changing to be able to be responsive to this, our policies changing within Child Protection Agency, but all the other agencies and judges and all of that we've been talking about. So it has to be system-wide. And so we are, I'd leave actually on Thursday for Brisbane, Australia, to train another cohort of trainers. And it's very exciting. There will be 60 trainers in Australia, and we have soon to be 40 trainers in Europe. Many of them, Scotland was really kind of a champion around this work and have, you know, they have a coercive control law. So there does not have to, you know, so as you well know, there has to be physical or sexual violence for an arrest. No longer in Scotland is that true. There's a law that covers coercive control, which is amazing. And that really came out of all of this kind of work.
That law was initiated a couple years ago in Great Britain. And it looks like
right.
it's traveling from there outward, which is, you
That's
know, we're
right.
we're way behind on that as far
right.
as you know, recognizing coercive control. Although I have to tell you, a couple years ago, I did a training with probation and parole officers. I think it was in Virginia or someplace. And I was prepared for kind of a frothy little, you know, not really paying much attention to what I had to say kind of reaction. And I was just, because I was doing the training on coercive control, and I was absolutely gobsmacked by this room full of people who immediately started going, well, you can't do anything, we can't do anything because it's not against the law, but if we have somebody on probation or parole, I mean, the whole room just started brainstorming what we could do, you know, from are
right.
there local city ordinances that are, you know, that are against the law and which we could nail them on that? Or, I mean, it was just the reaction to coercive control issues was just so rewarding. You know, probation and parole people
Isn't
were ready
great?
To tackle that. So that was very rewarding for me.
Yes, and that's really the work that we're talking about is collaboration to be changing the face of this.
Now, I don't have any compunctions about saying domestic violence is a problem for women. Okay. Yes, I know the statistics, and yes, I know that there are some men who are abused, and yes, I know blah blah blah. But overwhelmingly, we're talking women. Okay.
Right.
And I'm guileless about saying this, and I really kind of resent how we keep and this my father was abused by my mother.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, I am well aware that this exists. However, I lose total patience with the insistence that we somehow or other give the impression that it's 50-50. Just as many men are violated as women, just as many men are abused as women, blah blah blah. No, that's not true.
Right.
And I think that
right.
by constantly hammering on that, what we end up doing is watering down the significance of the problem for women. And whenever you say women, you also say children. Because
right.
even in this day and age, the women are the primary tied in with the children kind of thing.
Right.
When you are training people. I mean, how do you address that issue of this kind of insistence that we not just acknowledge that abuse can also be, you know, male, not just perpetrators, but male victims. Do you address that at all? I mean, how do you address that
yes.
while still being accurate?
Yes. Yes, we have to address it. Because as you know, doing training, if anyone in the room feels shut down around that, and there's always some who feel, you know, defensive that they need to hear us say that men can be victims as well, which is true, and it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
And what we talk about is, you know, in examples that you know, we all as faculty and part of the Institute use, our examples are real examples from cases and families. And so we talk about them and you know, 90% of them are cases where there's a male perpetrator and a female survivor. But we make space for, the model is designed to address gender double standards and that kind of thing, and yet it is when it's completely focused on facts and behaviors, it doesn't have to be about, this is about all men being perpetrators and all women being survivors. Because if we stay focused on facts and behaviors, then that's where it's at. So you can do great assessment with the model in same-sex couples, if there is a male victim, a female perpetrator, it's through the assessment around facts and behaviors that you get to the perpetrator. So there doesn't have to be a either or in that kind of a way. It's a really important piece of the model. So we talk about the assessment being gender neutral, but not saying that the approach is gender neutral, because domestic violence is a very gendered thing, and making space for that as well. So we, you know, we acknowledge it, and it's not uncommon for, you know, those in the room who often are struggling with that. It's not uncommon for them to have had a family member who was a man who, you know, was, you know, abused in some particular kind of way, or emotionally abused, or all of that. And that they, you know, people just need to hear their experience will be validated and acknowledged in the room. And the model makes all the space in the world for that, because it stays on an assessment framework that doesn't have to be making assumptions. That's a really important part of the model, that it doesn't make assumptions and generalizations, that it really stays focused on coercive control and facts and behaviors.
One other comment that I have, and I'm looking at the clock, so I might be sounding like I'm rushing you, and I apologize.
Go ahead. No worries.
But one other question that I had was, when you were talking about assessing and mapping the perpetrator behavior, I think for so many of us, and for so long, we've had to couch anything about domestic violence into these clinical generalized terms in order to appear objective. If you went into
right.
court and said, oh, well, he does this, this, and this, and it makes me feel this, this, and this, and that, boom, you're immediately discredited, because you're whining, it's personal, you know, they don't want to hear it. And
right.
so we purposely couched everything in these technical terms that were basically meaningless as to explaining behaviors. But now what you're talking about is going back to applying those, you know, getting rid of those objective terminology things, and talking specifically about how did that make the child feel. Is there
right.
any resistance to that kind of an approach, either on the part of psychologists who are writing reports, or child protective services that are writing reports, or in the court system?
I have to say, and I've been doing this this particular part of the work for, where are we now, for, you know, like 7 or 8 years, that when people get to the, you know, the assessment piece, and when we really start talking about facts and behaviors, and they have their own cases and their own families that they work with, and when we do that application and use case studies and all of that, it really is not a stretch for people to understand the difference between, if you said this couple has a history of domestic violence, or this is her third relationship where she's, you know, chosen something around that, if we stay really focused on the what actually happened and the facts and behaviors, it's not a stretch really for anyone to go, well, I guess it really does make a difference. If you tell me that the couple engages in domestic violence, what do I know about that? I don't really know anything. And yet, if you give me this information that, since we've been talking about, that is on this mapping tool, which is so specific and gives me the narrative for this family and this child, it's not a hard stretch for people to be like, this one is way better. I mean, we do a lot around documentation and looking at, you know, what documentation will get you where you want to go, and how does documentation look right now, and what does good documentation look like? And it's night and day. So it's not, people aren't like, well, I don't know, you know, I don't know that I want to, you know, why do I need to know that, you know, that he slapped her 3 times in the kitchen and then, you know, dragged her in there? And it's like, well, because if we say that there was physical violence, your imagination can go wherever it wants to go. It can be that, you know, that there was a slap, or that there was strangulation. And without, when we're not dealing with concrete facts and behaviors, we're missing out on the severity of the danger and risk to the children and the survivor, and really missing how are we doing determinations on if this child is safe. Right? And what do we know about their safety and their well-being? Right? So it's not just that they're not being hit, but what is the perpetrator's choices meaning to their everyday life? You know, and are they, you know, who is nurturing them? Who is giving them stability? Who is, you know, giving them space to heal? Those kinds of things. Are we doing assessment around who's doing Well, how's the survivor dealing with that with the children? And what is the perpetrator doing towards that or not? And then how, and if we know that's what kids need, then how are we capturing that information? And that's how we get to the place where it's not just, you know, kind of meh, or generic. Because, you know, every family where there's domestic violence, there's similarities, but there's differences, right? And that specificity right. is crucial for us to be doing work, to be changing the future for those survivors and children and perpetrators. Families are choosing to stay together. We need to be able to be doing the work towards perpetrator change. It's, we can't banish perpetrators to an island. And children, you know, perpetrators can and fathers can be really important to children. So we need to be careful. You know, the Safe and Together model isn't about good and bad people, right? It's about behaviors and good and bad behaviors. And that can, you know, that we can work with. Case plans for change need to be as specific as the behaviors that we've learned about. So if in a, in their case plan,
Yeah, I we could keep going for a long time, but I see our clock is coming to an end here. I really, really would love to know more about this. I would just love to. How can people learn more? Where can they go?
They can, you know, a good first stop is to our website, which is the safeandtogetherinstitute.com. And on there, there's great blogs to read. There's lots of video to hear. You know, all of us and David in particular talking about the work and the Safe and Together model. If anybody is in Denver or wants to come to Denver, our annual conference, our North American annual conference is in November, the 13th to the 15th, and information would be on the website. And yeah, and in general, go ahead.
Oh, I'm just looking at the clock, and I need to rush you along a little bit. But
yes.
So the website is the place to go for more information. Heidi, thank you so much for enlightening me and sharing with me what you are doing at the Institute. And I hope that you can come back sometime and give us more information and give us an update on where you're at. Thank you
That
very
would be
much,
fabulous.
Heidi.
Yes, thank you so much for having me. It was lovely.
Join us again next week for Three Women, Three Ways.